Hello, welcome to the Rethink Your Understanding podcast, where we dive deep into transformative insights on leadership, agile, lean, DevOps, value stream management, and flow engineering. I'm your human host, Phil Clark. I've been leading technology teams for over two decades in both eras of software delivery. In each episode, the AI-generated hosts dive into key concepts and insights from my articles and blog posts. While this conversation is generated by AI, there may be occasional errors or misinterpretations that differ slightly from the original material. Join me as we explore and improve our understanding of digital transformation. I hope this inspires you to read the original article and reach out to me to collaborate. You will find a link to the article in the show notes. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, please like, rate, and follow us on your podcast provider of choice. Your support helps us reach more listeners, and every review counts. Stay tuned for more thought-provoking content, and thanks for being part of our podcast experiment and journey. When companies remove agile leaders, roles like Scrum Masters or Agile Delivery Managers, they often assume the system will self-regulate. But what really happens when no one is accountable for team health, continuous improvement, or flow? In this episode, the AI hosts unpack my article about the quiet erosion of agility inside modern organizations, where well-intentioned efficiency moves up the dismantling the very disciplines that make agile work. Drawing on real-world transformations, I argue that while frameworks may fade, the principles and mindset of agile leadership must endure. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a really critical strategic decision happening right now across, well, a lot of major tech organizations. It's the elimination of the dedicated agile leader role. You know, we're talking about the Scrum Master, the Agile Delivery Manager, maybe a dedicated coach.
Right, those system stewards.
Yeah.
The ones focused on team performance and flow.
Exactly. And we've built this deep dive around a really insightful analysis by Phil Clark, specifically his article, What Happens When We Eliminate the Agile Leader?
Yes. From his site, rethinkyourunderstanding.com. It's a great piece.
It really is. A must read if you're trying to get your head around the dynamics of modern software delivery today.
And our mission here is, well, pretty simple.
Yeah.
Let's unpack the core drivers behind this rapid organizational redesign we're seeing.
Why are companies removing these roles?
Yeah. And what does Phil's analysis suggest are the kind of hidden costs, the critical ones?
Mm-hmm.
We need to look closely at what happens to the specific disciplines of, well, flow, team health, and continuous improvement.
When that dedicated stewardship just vanishes.
Precisely.
Right. And the premise is compelling because this decision, it often stems from one of two common scenarios, doesn't it?
Usually, yeah.
Maybe you've got new leadership coming in. They're determined to simplify the delivery structure, streamline things.
Right.
Or the organization has maybe bought into this idea that Agile itself has somehow failed, that it's dead.
Hmm.
Okay, so let's unpack that first. This pervasive idea, Agile is dead.
Right.
When you hear that claim, you dig a bit deeper and realize people are almost never really attacking the core principles, are they? The things that actually enable high-performing teams.
No, not usually. Like, who's seriously arguing against delivering in small batches?
Yeah.
Or learning fast from actual feedback?
Or, you know, constantly adapting to change. That's just efficient product development at its core.
Exactly. What's fascinating here, and Phil highlights this, is the distinction. It's between those foundational principles.
Yeah.
And the rigid implementation that often followed. The backlash isn't really against the spirit of Agile. It's against the packaged version. The one commercialized and sold through these massive, expensive transformation playbooks.
And standardized with, like, two-day certifications.
Exactly. The problem, as Phil notes, is often poor implementation, not the ideas themselves.
Okay, but hang on. If the problem is poor implementation, if teams were doing this rigid, maybe ineffective Agile, why is the fix usually eliminating the dedicated steward, the person who's supposed to be the process expert? Why not fix the implementation instead?
That's where it gets murky, isn't
yeah.
it? Phil points out that a lot of the confusion originates from how things got blended early on.
Blended? How so?
Well, early consulting efforts took valuable practices from different sources. Think story points and user stories, which actually came from extreme programming, XP.
Right. Not originally Scrum.
Not originally Scrum, no. But they got rigidly baked into what became known as textbook Scrum. It created this kind of monolithic, one-size-fits-all structure. And Scrum, fundamentally, is meant to be a lightweight framework for managing complexity. That's its purpose.
But when organizations treat it like an inflexible checklist, focusing only on the rituals, the stand-ups, the reviews, the planning,
then it becomes what people call cargo cult agile. You know the term?
Yeah. Copying the rituals without understanding why. Building the landing strip but not knowing about planes.
Exactly. In software, it's like doing the daily stand-up religiously but not actually achieving transparency or adapting based on what's learned. And when that ritual fails to deliver results,
the organization blames the framework. And then the associated role, the Scrum Master, seems disposable.
Precisely. They assume the role itself must disappear.
You know, if you are wrestling with these kinds of organizational questions, I really do strongly encourage you to check out Phil Clark's site, rethinkyourunderstanding.com. Get the full context of his analysis.
Definitely worth the read.
We're going to dive into the specific consequences he outlines here, but just know we might deviate slightly sometimes to make sure everything's clear. We want to cover the full scope of his findings, though.
Okay, so let's pivot a bit. Move away from just the titles, like Scrum Master, and focus on the actual function.
Good idea.
Because as delivery practices matured, the role titles evolved, right?
Yeah.
We started seeing agile coaches, and critically, the agile delivery manager, or ADM.
Right, the ADM.
And this shift was really a recognition that these leaders were acting as dedicated system stewards. Mm. They weren't just facilitators anymore.
And crucially, these system stewards, they were performing specialized, pretty sophisticated tasks. It wasn't just about booking rooms for meetings, was it?
Oh, absolutely not. Their core value was enabling system health and, importantly, flow.
So what did that involve practically?
Well, several key things. First, actively coaching the team for a sustainable pace, avoiding burnout. Second, resolving those complex, often messy cross-team dependencies that can stall big initiatives.
The things that fall between the cracks.
Exactly. And third, really championing deep team health, psychological safety, and fostering organizational experimentation, pushing the boundaries a bit.
Okay.
And perhaps most critically, they were the specialists using hard quantitative data. We're talking about analyzing flow metrics, things like cycle time, lead time, throughput.
The real indicators of performance.
Yes. The specific indicators that surface bottlenecks, diagnose poor handoffs between teams or stages, and actually measure delivery performance against tangible business outcomes. This expertise, it's a specialized skill set. It's not trivial.
But, okay, we have to acknowledge a reputation issue here. The reason this elimination could even happen in the first place.
Sure.
Phil addresses this, how the role's credibility, frankly, took a massive hit because the industry scaled so incredibly rapidly.
Yeah, the explosion of those easy, you know, two-day certification courses.
Right. It flooded the market with certified experts who, let's be honest, often lacked the necessary deep coaching experience or that real understanding of systemic flow.
And that uneven quality, and which was really a byproduct of commercialization, not a failure of the role concept itself, it made a lot of technical and product leaders deeply skeptical.
They saw it as overhead.
Exactly. They concluded the function was just overhead because maybe they only ever experienced a low-quality version of it.
Okay, so that brings us right to the core of this deep dive then. When that dedicated agile leader is eliminated, where do these specialized system stewardship tasks actually land? And what are the trade-offs, the ones we might not see immediately?
This is where the structural redesign really starts to bite.
Right.
And the trade-offs typically land in, well, three main structural shifts that Phil outlines. The first, and probably the most common one we see, is absorbing these duties directly into the engineering manager EM role.
Ah, okay. The EM takes it on.
Yeah. And the appeal is obvious, right? Simplicity. One person is now supposedly fully accountable for both the team's technical output and its delivery structure and process. Clean lines on the org chart.
But isn't that just good management? I mean, don't high-performing leaders already have to balance technical excellence, people coaching, and process improvement? Why does adding this specific ADM function suddenly break the EM role?
Because it creates immediate and crucially sustained overload. It often forces EMs to abandon the really important long-term investment aspects of their role.
How so?
Well, think about it. EMs are already juggling hiring, technical architecture reviews, strategic people development, performance management, incident response. The list goes on.
It's a big job already.
It's huge. Now, add high-level flow analysis, deep dependency resolution across teams, facilitating complex retrospectives, something inevitably has to give. Usually it's the proactive improvement stuff.
Okay, overload makes sense. What else?
Furthermore, and this is really critical, you face a severe loss of neutrality.
Loss of neutrality, explain that.
This crystallized function of the agile leader, the coach, requires them to be, well, an empathetic coach, someone who can facilitate deep, sometimes uncomfortable, but honest retrospective reflection, especially on failures.
Right, creating psychological safety.
Exactly. Someone who removes psychological barriers.
Yeah.
Now, when the EM, the person who conducts your performance review, decides on your raise or promotion, takes on that specific coaching role.
It fundamentally damages psychological safety, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Team members are just far less likely to openly admit process debt, systemic issues, or personal struggles to their direct evaluator compared to a dedicated, neutral coach whose job is purely about system improvement.
So the specialization just fades away. That deep daily focus on flow metrics, on process improvement experiments, on resolving systemic friction, it gets instantly deprioritized whenever, say, a technical emergency pops up or a big hiring sprint takes precedence.
Precisely. It's like stopping preventative maintenance on your car. It runs fine today, maybe tomorrow.
But you're accumulating massive technical debt, and in this case, process debt, that pretty much guarantees a breakdown later.
You got it. Okay, so that's the EM absorption. Hmm. The second dangerous shift Phil identifies is redistribution to program management.
Okay, so spreading it out to the program managers, PMs.
Yeah. Here, the PMs, who often do hold certifications in Scrum or similar frameworks, they act as advisors. Maybe they maintain some high-level flow metrics across multiple teams.
So keeping an eye on things from a distance.
Kind of. This strategy is often implemented as a sort of compromise. It's a way to maintain some oversight without the dedicated role. However, its big limitation is scale and, critically, proximity.
Meaning?
Well, a single PM might be supporting, say, 6, maybe even 8 teams. They're simply too distant. They can't capture the day-to-day nuances, observe the micro-behaviors in a daily stand-up that signal a problem, or coach a specific team that's struggling with, say, keeping their work board hygienic and useful.
They're too spread thin.
Way too spread thin. PMs, by necessity, can really only focus on the biggest, most critical cross-organizational systemic impediments, that vital work of continuous improvement at the team level.
Like drilling into local flow data, tackling small team-level bottlenecks, guiding local experiments.
Exactly. That risks fading entirely when the expertise isn't embedded within the team's daily operations. It's just too far removed.
Okay. And the third scenario, this sounds like the idealistic one.
It often is. It's distributing or rotating the responsibilities across the team members themselves. The idea is aiming for true self-organization.
Sounds good in theory.
In theory. But Phil notes, and I think this is spot on, it only works reliably for the most exceptionally mature and stable teams. And let's be honest, those are pretty rare in a high-pressure corporate environment.
True. And even then.
Even when teams are mature, rotation itself has severe limits. Frequent rotation breaks continuity and deep learning. The team loses the chance for any one person to develop true mastery in coaching, facilitation, or complex flow analysis. It becomes shallow.
And under pressure.
And, most predictably, under any wave of delivery pressure, a tight deadline, a critical bug tasks related to improvement and long-term sustainability. They are inevitably the first things dropped. Always.
Because they don't produce immediate visible features.
Right. The system simply lacks a dedicated owner whose primary focus is its long-term health, not just the immediate output.
You know, this entire discussion really suggests that the failure isn't necessarily structural, like which box people sit in on the org chart.
Mm-hmm.
As much as it is a failure of leadership perspective, it sounds like success often comes down not to the structure, but to the leadership mindsets driving those decisions.
Absolutely. Phil makes a great distinction here between two primary mindsets. First, you have the execution first, or you might call it command and control mindset.
Okay, execution first.
This type of leadership views dedicated facilitation, coaching, anything that looks like process improvement as purely overhead, waste.
They don't see the value?
They fundamentally believe that delivery is managed efficiently through hierarchy, strict timelines, and individual accountability. They might accept distributed ownership of process improvement as good enough because their absolute priority is immediate output, not necessarily long-term systemic health.
Okay, that's one mindset. What's the alternative?
The alternative is the systems-enabling mindset. You might also hear terms like servant leadership or flow-based leadership.
Systems enabling.
Right. This leadership recognizes that enablement, continuous improvement, and sophisticated flow management actually require dedicated focus and, importantly, professional skill. It's not something just anyone can do well part-time.
So they invest in it.
They invest in dedicated leaders specifically to strengthen flow and collaboration because they understand that sustained high performance is a function of system health, not just individual heroism or cracking the whip.
That leads to another point Phil makes, this dangerous consequence of merging roles, the pursuit of the myth of the unicorn.
Ah, the unicorn.
Yes.
Organizations essentially create these impossible job descriptions, right?
Yeah.
Expecting one single individual, maybe the EM, maybe a product manager, to possess deep technical design mastery, high-level leadership effectiveness, and delivery outcome ownership, and also sophisticated process coaching skills, all at the same time.
It's an insane combination of skills to expect in one person.
It really is. It's a cognitive minefield. And while, okay, maybe these incredibly high performers do exist somewhere.
Pretty rare.
Extremely rare. And Phil notes that even they struggle profoundly with the constant task switching, juggling all those competing, highly specialized priorities.
The cognitive conflict is just brutal. Think about it. Do I spend this afternoon writing the critical documentation for our new API architecture? Or do I spend it analyzing last month's cycle time data to plan our next process improvement experiment?
The most urgent, immediate task usually wins.
Always. Yeah. Which inevitably leads to accumulating that process debt we talked about.
Yeah.
The improvement work gets deferred indefinitely.
And the cost of relying on that mythical unicorn?
It's a profound vulnerability for the organization.
Yeah.
When that single, unique high performer inevitably leaves, burnout, better offer, whatever.
The organization loses everything in one go. All the context, the flow awareness, the process continuity, it vanishes overnight.
And replacing them. It's almost impossible because that specific broad mix of skills is so hard to find, which leads to a massive, painful dip in team performance and systemic health.
Okay, so let's bring this all back together. Phil Clark's core conclusion seems to be this. The issue isn't really about whether practices like Scrum or Kanban will continue. They probably will in some form or another.
Right, the practices themselves aren't the main point.
The critical danger, the real risk, lies in losing dedicated stewardship, losing that individual or that function whose primary focus is systemic, continuous improvement, and the overall health of the delivery process.
Exactly. So what does this all mean for you? You, the listener, maybe you're a leader, maybe you're a team member, trying to decide on the right organizational structure.
What's the takeaway?
Well, the fundamental, absolutely necessary question leaders should be asking. It's not about a specific job title. It's about accountability.
Okay, what's the question?
The question is, who in our organization is explicitly responsible for enabling collaboration, removing systemic impediments, maintaining team health, promoting improvement experimentation, and driving learning across our delivery pipelines? Who owns that specifically?
That really is the entire game, isn't it?
Yeah.
If the answer to that question is no one, well, you've created a massive structural gap regardless of the role titles you've chosen to use or eliminate.
Yep. Or if the answer is partially someone you know through shared duties or rotated responsibilities.
And you absolutely must recognize the compromise you've made, acknowledge the diffusion of ownership, and accept the inevitable loss of that specialized focus and deep expertise.
Right. The core principles of agile things like empowered teams, fast feedback, efficiency, they don't just vanish overnight without a dedicated leader. But that crucial discipline of performance measurement, of systemic improvement, that suffers almost immediately.
And that risks a slow, almost invisible, creeping slide right back towards the rigid, hierarchical, and ultimately inefficient models that Agile was supposed to help us escape in the first place.
A return to the old ways, unintentionally.
Exactly. So here is a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe mull over. If your team or your organization has recently absorbed that Agile leader role into another function, stop and really consider which specialized function. Is it the flow metrics analysis, maybe? Is it the active psychological safety maintenance? Or perhaps it's the complex cross-team dependency resolution. Which one of those is most likely to be the very first to fade away entirely under the next intense wave of delivery pressure?
Good question.
And maybe more importantly, what is the immediate, potentially measurable cost of losing that specific function to your team's performance and your business's resilience? Something to think about until the next deep dive.